come up on a tight wire.
I'm not sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sines because he is out of town today, and this is Daniel Chacon for another edition of Words on a Wire. Both of us are writers, both Ben and I, and both of us have just come out with books. Ben just won the Penn Faulkner Award for his brilliant collection of stories, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club. And so he's out doing readings, and I just came out with a new book as well, Hotel Juarez, Stories, Rooms, and Loops. So I'm also on the road quite a bit. So Ben can't be here to talk with the poet Eduardo C. Corral, who is our guest today. He is a winner of the Yale Younger Poets Series for his beautiful book, Slow Lightning. And on Poetic License today, we have a local person, Pat Olchevsky Winston, who is going to take us down her own little memory lane. So stick around with us, and we'll be right back to talk to Eduardo C. Corral. Eduardo C. Corral is a Canto Mundo fellow. He holds degrees from Arizona State University and the Iowa Writers' Workshops. His poems have appeared in Best American Poetry 2012, Belote Poetry Journal, Wisache, New England Review, Plowshares, and many, many more. His work has been honored with a Discovery, the Nation Award, the J. Howard and Barbara M. J. Wood Prize, and many more. He has served as the Olive B. O'Connor Fellow in Creative Writing at Colgate University and as the Philip Roth Resident in Creative Writing at Bucknell University. Slow Lightning, his first book of poems, was selected by Carl Phillips as the 2011 winner of the Yale Series of Younger Poets Competition. He is the recipient of the Whiting Writers Award and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. He currently lives in New York City and teaches at Columbia University. Eduardo C. Corral, welcome to Words on a Wire.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, you know, you probably as much as anybody I've ever come in contact with, but you really seem to live the writer's life. You walk. I imagine you walk several hours a day. You hang out
on a good day. On a good day. And you know, the days I love to walk the best are the rainy, cloudy days.
Oh.
I was born in southern Arizona, and rain and cloudy days are special days over there. And those days I enjoy. The rest of the New Yorkers, they don't like those days. You could see in their face, and you know, there's kind of a different kind of attitude in the air. But I enjoy walking under umbrella through the parks, the streets, when it's raining, because it reminds me of Arizona, quite frankly. During the monsoon season in Arizona, during the summers, that's when it would rain a lot in southern Arizona, and I took every opportunity to hear and listen to the rain. If it was raining at 4 in the morning, I could hear the raindrops on the top of my parents' mobile home, the chimney. I would get up and go to the porch and listen and smell the rain.
It's
something very important to me.
Are you the kind of poet that carries around a notepad in case you want to sit down and write verses no matter where you are?
Yes, I always carry three kinds of notebooks. A really tiny one in my pocket, jean pocket, a bigger one in my messenger bag, and unfortunately now with my iPhone or iPad. And I swore not to be one of those poets who takes notes on a gadget. Once you buy a gadget, you got to incorporate it into your writing process.
Oh yeah, you can't let it go, man. They become they're great tools. I rely on my iPhone. You know what I do? Sometimes I'm starting to write a completely different genre. I'm starting to actually write for TV now, and so with fiction, I never wrote down ideas. I just kind of let them germinate, and if they wrestled me to the ground, I'd write them. But with with writing comedy for TV, you know, if I think of a joke, I'll just say it into my my iPhone and record it and then type it out later.
Yeah. Well, notebooks are so important to me because that's how I actually write. I draft. I go through my notebooks and I stitch together images, phrases, lines that seem to work together, and that's how I actually write. For the longest time, I thought that made me not a real poet because I thought, you know, that old romantic notion that I'll come to you in one sitting. or akin to you in different ways. But a poem for me exists scattered throughout my notebooks.
So wow.
That's
wow.
why I really value them. And for this first book, Slow Lightning, I wrote so many notebooks. I had about, when I finished the book, about 7 or 8 boxes of notebooks.
Oh, my gosh. And you find a poem within all those different pages, even though the pages weren't meant to be together at first.
Yeah. When I got the phone call from Carl Phillips that I had on the Yale, I was at the McDowell Colony in February 2011. And one of the first things I did after getting back home to Arizona, I went through my notebooks. Mm-hmm. One more last time, I said, you know, I'm done with this manuscript. It's going to be published. It's going to be a book, finally. So I did like a little ritual ceremony. I went through all the notebooks one more time and just pulled out every last image, phrase that kind of still resonated with me. And I pulled together a self-portrait poem. And that's actually the last poem that went into the book.
Oh, wow.
And I used it as a little, you know, a goodbye and a kissing off of those notebooks. You know, after a while, I got sick of those notebooks because, you know, like, they're taunting me, like, ha, ha, ha. You know, you can't find the gold in us. And after I finished that self-portrait poem, I taped them up, and I haven't looked at them since.
Just to clarify for our listeners, we're speaking to Eduardo Corral. You mentioned the Yale series. You were the recipient of the Yale series of younger poets, and which is as prestigious as it gets for a new book. And your career has just shot up ever since you won that. You won the Whiting Award.
The Whiting Writers Award, yeah.
The Whiting Writers Award, and you're doing a lot of readings. You get award after award, and you just are running with it, and you are living the poet's life, and I deeply, deeply admire that. And I know when you're not walking the city and writing in your notebook and you're not reading poetry, you read not only poetry, but you read commentary on poetry. How much time do you spend reading?
I spend, on average, 2 to 3 hours a day reading. And that includes deep reading, reading for pleasure, and entertainment reading. So it means all kinds of reading.
Okay, so give me an example of deep reading and an example of entertainment reading.
Entertainment reading is easy. Online news sources, Huffington Post, entertainment gossip websites, Facebook, awesome. Blogs, that kind of stuff. That's kind of light reading, entertainment reading. Deep reading is like critical essays. Right now I'm rereading Philip Larkin's little short essay on his poetics, The Pleasure Principle. I'm reading again and again just to figure it out, what he's trying to say. And also, Joy Graham has a wonderful short little essay on silence, which I keep reading again and again. I also love to read poet interviews. Actually, one of my favorite things to read, and my favorite part of the interviews is not when the poet is on the soapbox, you know, speaking. This is what I know. This is what I've learned. It's those casual asides about the writing process, their day-to-day life, what inspired a poem. Those kind of small moments that I look for in interviews that mean a lot to me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I love reading interviews with writers, poets, fiction writers, playwrights. It doesn't matter. I learn so much from them. Your book, Slow Lightning, it's a beautiful book. I mean, it is probably one of my favorite books of poems in the last, you know, several years. And it's just so bold, and it's so courageous. And I'm speaking specifically about how you are really breaking into mainstream poetry world. You are a poet up there with the other poets, but you still use Spanish.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't shy away from it, and you don't italicize it. Was that a struggle for you at first? Because there's a lot of Spanish in this book put out by Yale University Press.
Yes, it is. I mean, when I was a graduate student, in Iowa, and I never even imagined or even dared write code-switching poems, you know, poems that shuttle back and forth from English and Spanish, because I was a bad graduate student. I was writing to use my mentors and colleagues. I knew none of them knew Spanish.
Uh-huh.
So I had a block right at the beginning of my writing career. But it was after graduate school. But it just dawned on me one day, why can't I write a poem that kind of mimics, echoes the way I think? And it was such a simple little epiphany. Oh, why can't I do that on page? And that's how the code-switching poem started happening for me, just to mimic the way my my process in my mind unfurls. Because, you know, a sentence will begin in English and in Spanish, even at the phrasal level, that kind of stuff, again and again. And I wanted to also honor the language, the diction around me.
Right.
The Spanish in my book is not academic Spanish. I mean, the Spanish in my book will get you laughed out of a Mexican university.
Exactly.
It would totally get you laughed out of a Mexican university. But that's the music I know. And that's the music my parents gave to me. And I had to use it in the work.
I love this poem on page 38. I don't know if it has a title. I don't think it does. But it just, qué chido his chistes. Qué chido his tocayo. Qué chido his peso-colored balas. It's a
I challenge myself with a poem because, you know, I'm probably bocho. My Spanish is, you know, it's a conversational. If it put me in a Mexican university, I would flounder. Thank you. But I wanted to include words in this section that I had a hard time pronouncing and uttering just to train myself. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's just amazing that not only did you do that, but Carl Phillips and the poetry world, the Gabacho poetry world, and not that Carl Phillips is Gabacho, but that him and the Gabacho poetry world were able to not only accept that you're going to write in that language, but to embrace it and to promote it and to find the beauty in it. I just think that's fantastic.
Yeah, once I made the choice to actually, you know, pursue code switching and make it part of my toolbox, you know, it was there. So when Spanish came to me during the drafting process, it was there. It had, you know, I kept it. You know, I don't like poems that use Spanish as ethnic embellishment.
Right.
Yeah. Con leche italicized, the moon like piñata. You know, they use Spanish as to indicate here's the otherness in this poem. You know,
right.
My Spanish. If you take the Spanish out of my poems, the code switching poems, the poem collapses.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
It
has to be a vital part of the poem. It's not ethnic cultural embellishment.
It's not a Big Mac with salsa.
Yeah, exactly.
It is completely organic. And I think that's key to good poetry or good fiction or good anything. If you could take one aspect out of it and it doesn't collapse, then that aspect probably doesn't belong there.
Yeah. And also had it. Big fear, though. I mean, anxieties about the manuscript when I finished it. Like, all that Spanish, all that code switching, all that slang, all that very, like, border-specific Spanish. Who's going to make sense of this? It's, you know, I'm going to have to find, like, my ideal reader to get a prize or something. And like you said, Spanish is not italicized. They're not put in context. And there's no glossary.
Yeah. I like that, too. Absolutely.
Yeah. And Carl Phillips never asked for a glossary. Yale University Press never asked for a glossary. I would have said no, of course, but yeah, they never asked, which I find amazing and I'm very thankful for. Carl Phillips and Yale University Press allowed me to, you know, be the poet that I needed to be.
Yeah, well, I tell you, nobody could read this book and accuse you of being a sellout. That's for dang sure.
But on the flip side, Daniel, I have received a handful of emails from, like, young Latino poets in MFA programs in this country, sort of furious with me that I do code switch a lot in my work.
Really?
And the gist of it is that they are afraid that their teachers, their peers, are going to expect them to do what I'm doing.
Right,
I always tell them, no, you have to follow your language. You have to write the poems you need to write. You know, resist the pressure to write a certain type of poem in workshops or outside of workshops. Do what you need to do on the page.
Yeah, and don't feel you have to be a cultural missionary to, you know, to do it, to teach about the culture.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And there are a few things, you know, I often tell students, you know, listen to language, follow language. It will tell you everything. It will tell you what it wants to say, and it will suggest a form, a shape, a container. Just follow it. Don't try to lead it.
You know, and it's the same with fiction. I'm always telling my students that, you know, fiction and poetry were torn asunder, you know, years ago, but really that's the same source, and that source is following the language, is allowing the language to take you into the story, allowing the language to bring up the ideas as opposed to idea first, you know, story first, plot first. That's what I love about this book. The language is just such a pleasure. So at what point in your poetry career were you exposed to Jose Montoya? And what does Jose Montoya mean to you now?
I was exposed to Jose Montoya very early. As an undergrad at Arizona State University in a Chicano literature course taught by Dr. Arturo Aldama, who works in Colorado now. that's the whole reason I'm a poet, because of him, Dr. Lama, and that class. I took that class thinking it was going to be a literature course, a survey course, you know, read a text, write a paper, easy A, you know, that's what I thought. But it turned out to have a workshop component. And I almost dropped it, Daniel, because I'm like, who wants to write poetry?
No way.
But
what were you going to do before you were going to be a poet?
I had no idea. My first declared major was psychology. Then I took a couple of labs. I'm like, no, that's too much work. I'm not interested, and it's too much work, and it's kind of iffy, you know, those labs, experiments. I was kind of floundering until I picked up a Chicano Studies course brochure on campus, and I found it interesting. And it was the first time I heard the word Chicano, too, as an undergrad.
Oh, really?
So I signed up for a course, and with Dr. Aldama, and everything changed for me, because after I read my first poem in class, my hands shaking.
Oh, my.
A terrible little poem. He saw something in that. Wow. And he encouraged me to keep writing, and he encouraged me to meet the MFA faculty, Norman Duby, Alberto Rios, Arizona State, and they took me under their wing, and they were very kind to me. So that's how I started. So I'm very helpful. He introduced us to Montoya, you know, his work. Mm. And what Jose Montoya reminded me of was one of my uncles, the way one of my uncles spoke.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I'm like, oh, that's really it kept my attention. This poet, who's an anthologized, who's in books, who's published, who's well-respected among his peers, sounds like my uncle who gets drunk Saturday night and tells these stories with this kind of a specific language. It sounds like my uncle. I remember thinking that. So I always kept that in my head. And so when I had my own breakthrough after graduate school about allowing myself to code switch, I immediately went back to Jose Montoya and read him for inspiration.
Wow. You know, Jose Montoya, for me, is probably an excellent example of Rascuache as an aesthetic. Taking the language, you know, the everyday language and the everyday images that are, supposedly lowbrow, and turning them into art. And you have a lot of rascuachismo in your book. There's a lot of stuff from the border, a lot of stuff from the community that you take and you turn into beautiful poetry. And I'm thinking particularly of the border triptych. You have this story in part one, which is kind of a legend on the border. Only I think one of the versions is with a donkey. This guy trying to cross the border every day with a donkey, and the border patrol agent is suspicious of him, you know, but every day, you know, he crosses with the donkey.
I keep on crossing.
Yeah, and he searches him, never can find anything, and then finally, years later, he admits he was smuggling donkeys. And you do that with a bicycle in that triptych.
Yep.
And I love how you put it in the point of view of the customs agent. How do you decide what kind of material is going to make a good poem?
I remember writing that poem around 2006. Mm-hmm. And I was back in Arizona, Southern Arizona, with my parents in their mobile home. I'm thinking, and I wanted to work with a sonnet form. And I'm like, what should I do? Like, what can I do with a sonnet? How can I make a sonnet border-specific, Arizona-specific? Well, talk about the border, border crossers, border agents. So that's how that started. And then I started remembering all the little legends, tales I heard growing up. And so that's the first part of the sonnet. Then I remembered a story a woman told me about crossing the border and being afraid of being sexually assaulted, and the advice her grandmother gave her to fend that off, fend that kind of assault. And that became the part of the second sonnet.
Yeah.
And the third sonnet came to me when I just imagined walking to the desert with a very handsome guy and getting lost. And I'm thinking, like, okay, we're lost in the desert. What are we going to do? Like, okay, how do we survive?
Yeah. Well, they're great poems. I highly recommend anyone to pick up this book, Slow Lightning, by Eduardo C. Corral, which is the Yale Series of Younger Poets winner. One more thing I want to say about your book. I do read a lot of poetry. I don't suspect I read as much as you do, but I read a lot, especially since we get a lot of great poets on this show. And I, you know, sometimes reading a book of poems a week. Yeah. I go to a lot of readings. A lot of my friends are poets. And I have never seen a book of poems where you get to a page and suddenly it's like a centerfold and you have to You have to move the book over to the other side in order to read the long lines of the poem. Where did you come up with this? I think it's I love one of my favorite poems, Didat Deus. Deus?
Well, it's actually the state motto of Arizona, you know, God in riches, yeah.
Oh, okay. And like one of my favorite poems in the book is written that way. How did you come up with this idea, and was there resistance on your on the part of your publisher? And not to ask too many questions at once, but we're running out of time, would you read that poem to us?
Sure. Two things. It's actually among, I would say, you know, experimental presses, avant-garde presses, those kind of writers and presses, it's actually this kind of format is very common. Especially people post work with longer lines.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I encourage my press to do this. Well, they asked me if it was okay with me because I didn't want those lines broken randomly.
Right.
Because the way it would have to be typeset. You know, I spent 9.5 years working on this manuscript, and I was like, oh no, I don't think I'm going to, I can't deal with them. It would break me if the lines were not broken the way I live. So that's why. And also, I like the notion, the idea of readers turning a book.
Yeah, interacting with it in a physical way.
Interactive, yeah. It becomes a steering wheel, or you're forced to move your body to read poetry.
Right.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
It made me happy.
But that's a beautiful poem, Didat Deus. Would you be willing to read that for our poem of the week?
Oh, sure. You know, my friends berated me when I titled it this poem. Because it's Latin, and I'm not sure I'm even pronouncing it right, because I have a tendency to, like, use words I can't pronounce. So hopefully the listeners will forgive us if I'm not doing it right.
Okay.
But Latin is the state motto of Arizona, which means God enriches. Deat Deus. One. In high school, I worked as a bag boy. To prevent shoplifting, my boss had me follow the Mexicans and the Native Americans who came in to shop. I was slightly troubled by this, so I only followed the handsome men. Two. I learned to make love to a man by touching my father. I would unlace his work boots, pull off his socks, and drag my thumbs along the arches of his feet. When he slept, I would trace the veins of his neck, blue beneath my fingertip. He would lift me each morning onto the bathroom counter, dot my small palms with dollops of shaving cream, so I could lather his face.
That was Eduardo Corral. Well, thank you for appearing on our show, Eduardo Corral. And please check out his book, Slow Lightning. And we look forward to your next book. Do you know when that's coming out?
Oh, I'm giving myself 5 to 6 years
awesome.
To write it.
Awesome. You got to do it. You got to do it. Yeah.
Thank you, gracias, Daniel, for inviting me. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pat Oshevsky-Winston, and my poetic license today is about the book I wrote recently called The Curious Childhood of Patio. This all came about after about 8 years of writing in my journal and meeting an editor in town that read some of this and said, you know what, you need to finish your book. Because at that point, I wasn't confident at all that I even had a story to tell. And she persuaded me and helped me for about a year. And we put it together. Anyway, so it was a long process and really probably the hardest thing I've ever done. It all came together and came out last September. It's making it big in my hometown of White Bear Lake, Minnesota, where I grew up. So I thought I would read about a chapter called Learning to Fight Back. So I wrote about learning to fight back with my brothers just because I think it was important as the youngest child and the only girl that it was important that I did learn to fight. They did pick on me all the time up until the point where I stood ground and challenged them. So there was numerous occasions where they would have really caused a lot of pain and put me in the hospital probably. But anyway, I learned to fight back. And so from that point on, I think I still have learned to fight back. It starts like this. My brothers used to terrorize me. The first time, they cornered me in my room, dragged me to the bathroom, and tried damn hard to flush my foot down the toilet. The second time, they tied ropes around my ankles and wrists and hung me from the springs under my mattress. Both times, I screamed, "Bloody murder!" But no one came to my rescue. The third time they tried to get me, I was ready. When I heard them coming toward my bedroom, I hid behind my bedroom door with a baseball bat in hand. They were trying to be sneaky, whispering and plotting outside my bedroom. But their voices were loud enough for me to overhear their plan. Quote, "Mom's at the store, so let's grab Patty and tie her up to the clothesline pole in the backyard." I held my breath and stood stick still behind the door waiting for them to open it. Melvin was the first one to come in. I was glad because he was always the instigator of these terrorist attacks. I blasted him with my strongest left swing right to the back of his head. Fortunately, my swing wasn't strong enough to do him serious harm. But he went flying into my bed, and Johnny went running in the opposite direction to hide out somewhere in the house, probably still close enough to hear what happened next. As Melvin lay moaning, I stood over him and laughed. I said, "No more. You aren't going to pick on me anymore. I'll fight back each time you come near me and clobber you over the head with worse than you got today if you ever try that again." Stunned, he looked up at me with a look of newfound respect. I had a feeling he was proud of my attempt to fight back. It was almost as if he was thinking, "Well, it's about time you learned to defend yourself." Now that he knew what I was capable of, I said, "Get out of here and don't come back. Tell Johnny I'll give him the same too if he ever tries anything." And so it went. Melvin left my room and never harassed me again. However, he eventually witnessed many future fights that I had in our front yard with the neighbor boys, whenever I felt a need to teach them a lesson or two. Mostly, it was all in fun. But I remember one incident when I once again used force to make my point. Here's what happened. One midsummer evening, I was washing the dishes and Johnny was drying them. Just as I was just about to scrub down the frying pan to remove the burnt crusts of the fish sticks Mom had fixed for supper, Johnny picked up a dish that I had washed and said, "This isn't clean. You missed a couple spots." I turned to him and said, "It is too clean," and because I had that frying pan in my hand and was perturbed by his criticism, I hit him over the head with it. He immediately started screaming, "Mom, she hit me!" I went running out the back door and down the street to my friend Dee's house to wait until this little domestic dispute blew over. Johnny had started it, but I had ended it. I later admitted that I had overreacted and told Johnny I was sorry. He also said he was sorry, really sorry. Doing dishes was a quiet event from that point on. My brothers continued to tease and pick on me whenever they had a chance, but at least I had learned to stand my ground and fight back if I needed to do so. This was an important lesson, one that I would need to recall a few more times during my childhood. But that's another story, or two. That little story I read was from the chapter Learning to Fight Back in my book called The Curious Childhood of Patty O. I'm Pat Olszewski Winston for Words on a Wire.
I'd like to thank my guest, Eduardo C. Corral, for joining us. Don't forget to check out his book. I guarantee you will not be disappointed. And Pat Olszewski Winston for sharing her poetic license. I have to tell you a little bit something about Pat. I met her at the dog park. Every Sunday, we would take our dogs to the same park, and she found out I was a writer, and I found out she was a writer. So I'm glad she finally got a chance to join us. And I hope her dog, Sunny, who is a very cute dog, not as cute as Kafka, is doing well. Thank you, Pat, for joining us. Make sure you join us next week and every week, Sunday at noon on KTEP 88.5 FM. I'm Daniel Chacon. And remember, the next book Ben reads may save my life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope.